Christianity is one blazing path of bhakti. And I think he was right. He says, and it's brilliant. They just ring the changes on love. You know, more love, O Christ, to thee, more love to thee, and so on. What a friend we have in Jesus. The parental aspect, child, parent aspect of love is given huge play. God is our Father and so on. But the friend aspect, what a friend we have in Jesus, and the parental towards the child at Christmas, infant, lowly, infant, holy, and all our paternal, maternal feelings of love get drawn to this figure. It just rings the changes on bhakti and does it beautifully, magnificently. The only thing is that it leaves out gnosis, you know. And those of us who by our spiritual personality type happen to be jhanic or gnostic in nature, well, it doesn't accommodate it. It hasn't accommodated us, which is why we've had to go abroad. I'm talking about myself. When I hit the Vedanta, boy, it was like the world's opening in something I had not found at all in Christianity. Now, I do now see that it was there, and even before these finds, you could find it like in Eckhart. It's magnificent in Eckhart. But Eckhart was banned for 400 years, and only about 20 years ago did the church lift its ban. And here he is, the supreme Gnostic in among the Christian mystics. Banned. I don't know. I get carried away. But tell me, what is that what you were?
Well, I'm wondering further then, was there a thread of Gnosticism before Christ?
Oh, of course.
So it goes. So in other words, there's this kernel of truth that is manifested, as I see it, in the different religions.
Right.
In different forms.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And this kernel of truth factors out one of the most basic divisions that we find concerns different, what I just used the phrase, spiritual personality types. And I think one of the major divides there is between those who on balance are more affective than reflective, affective being feeling. Feeling predominates more than thought, shall we say, the heart rather than the mind. And then there are others where it's the other way around. But both are present within us all. And as we said yesterday, in the end, the difference between them becomes less and less palpable until in the end, there is no difference at all. But along the way, there is a very real difference. Now, that division between what? Jhanis and bhaktis for the Indian terminology, and what should we say? Gnostics versus, I don't know what the other term in Christianity would be, but for the bhakti. But that difference is, I think, universal. Human, one finds it in all traditions, but in different ratios. And so to say that there was a Gnosticism before Christ, certainly, that it's as perhaps as long as human beings have been around.
Yeah, that was the next point.
Neil.
You know, Judaism, which is very prevalent in our culture, that seems to me it's very, very analogous to the Jhana Yoga tradition. The Jews are very much into studying and spend, you know, many, many hours studying the law, discussing Torah, getting into the intellectual implications of it. How would you relate that to the analogies you were drawing a minute ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's true that the rabbinic Judaism is has an immense cognitive component, but that cognition is different from Kabbalistic, right? And I think that in Judaism, one finds the Gnostic component in Kabbalism rather than in Rabbinic Judaism. Well, Bhakti Yoga is, I think that it is present within, I started to say rabbinic, we need another term. I think the Bhakti Yoga is present with throughout Judaism. That when I was having my theological training some 40 years ago, why we were just getting over the notion that the Old Testament was a book of judgment and the New Testament was a book of love. Now, now we can look back on that as kind of in the Dark Ages when that kind of division was, and bless my teachers, they pointed out that error, but it was an error that they inherited from their instructors, their teachers. One is the gospel of law, and the other is the gospel of love. What a facile, provincial, polemical, prejudiced point of view. You know? So I think the bhakti is right there, right within it.
In the same way with the Christian theological tradition in the Middle Ages, the Greek rationalism that came into Christianity would be more like rabbinical reflections rather than...
No, well, I don't think so. There's some of that. There is some of that. But I think that the reason that... I think the Greeks in the West had more... had a firmer hold on the Gnostic component of our nature than did the Judeo-Christian, which was more the Bhakti component. Because when you get Socrates, you know, there is a knowledge that saves.
What about the medieval theology, Thomas Aquinas, and things like that.
That would
have lost the Gnostic element if it came more.
I don't think, let's say it obscured it somewhat, but let's not forget that with all his 13 volume Summa, St. Thomas saw something at the end which caused him to put down his pen and say, I have seen that compared with which everything I've written is as straw. Now that's Gnostic. That is Gnostic.
And that's actually been documented that he did say that.
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah. Oh, yes. All right. Now let's see on this matter of Gnosticism within Christianity, the claim, and Elaine Pagels has said half the story very well. The other half she's also said, but that's not her unique contribution. You see, that the hypothesis now is that the Gnostic component was there along with the Bhaktic component within the teaching of Christ himself, but it became a minority position. And let's pause there. I think I'm prepared to go out on the limb and say that it is always the minority position. even in India. Now, India has far more room for jhana than the Western tradition, but even in India, most of them are bhaktis. This is a small proportion. And therein lies a problem. I think, what are we going to do with it? The charge of elitism. A small minority who think they have seen and known. And this is part of the prejudice, I think, against Gnosticism. And why, well, Gnosticism can lose. All right. If it was a minority, then here's then Pagels takes up the power element that in order to keep this movement integrated and from just splaying out into the individualism, which is always, shall we say, present within Gnosticism, that it had to be put down. And the bishops, therefore, consolidated their control over the institution by proclaiming Gnosticism heretical. And so it's been underground or virtually dormant for all these centuries. Now, that's the power reason for it having lost out. But there's also a cognitive reason, and that is that it was saying something that the majority simply could not comprehend. And because the majority could not see really what the Gnostics were talking about, they misread those works, thinking that they said something different from what they did. And granted, given that misreading, why they were right in saying that's not right. Is that's clear? Okay. So that's what happened historically. Now, with that kind of historical picture of Christian Gnosticism before it, we can turn now perhaps to itemize now what were the features of Christian Gnosticism. What were the ingredients? Now, we've been talking about those all along, but we might as well just itemize them now. Well, let me list several, and then we may want to add more. First is the esoteric aspect. Now, esoteric has the connotation of hidden, secret. And this raises, remember the first line that I've these are the secret teachings of Jesus. Which were told to Thomas. Now, let's pause on that for a moment and think about that element within religion. See, why secret? Well, the implication is that there are some things which, if told to everybody, would not be comprehended by everybody, and therefore they lend themselves to misinterpretation. Now we find this very widely in religions, in even in the standard gospel. Jesus says, cast not your pearls before swine. Why not? Well, there are two reasons. First of all, it may do the pearls no good. The swine may trample on them and they get crumbled and shattered to bits. But they might do the swine no good either if they got mixed in with their food or something like this, and the swine don't have gizzards, so they don't digest them well, something. So there's a double loss. The disciple is harmed and the teaching gets harmed. The teaching gets harmed by being misinterpreted. Now, even exoteric Christianity, we've lost sight of this. I remember this came as a real surprise to me, that even exoteric Christianity was regarded as esoteric in its early centuries. Esoteric in the sense that it was not to be divulged. There were secret teachings, and indeed, the Eucharist, the central rite, the communion, the Mass, had a point in it. There are about seven steps in it, and after about the seventh steps, the word Mass comes from Misa, meaning dismiss, as I recall. And there was a time when those who had not been initiated were expelled, were sent out. And there was a cry that would come out right in the midst of the communion service, to the doors, to the doors. And the bodyguards, the heavies, the bouncers, were appointed to go to the doors and see that those who had not been initiated did indeed leave. So there was that notion of esoteric knowledge, even in what comes to be exoteric. But of course, that notion of the secret character gets abandoned, lost, and it now gets flooded to everybody, and the question is whether that was a right move or whether there was some loss to the teaching through a popularization or reaching the common lowest level of comprehension, which obscured the more esoteric aspect, difficult aspects of this teaching.
Just take a minute to comment. As I understand, there were three major mystery religions simultaneously going on at this time. One of the things I've often wondered is, and I've heard some theories, but why was Christianity more successful than the other two?
Beats me. I don't know. I'm tempted to say, to give a kind of reflex answer, and to say that it was a genuine divine revelation. That means it had within it it was a channeling of the infinite into Western civilization, which gave it a power within that civilization to survive. But that's only a formalistic answer to your question.
Part of it is because Constantine ordered that his army be baptized.
Yeah, if you wanted to do it in historical terms, why, that would be, say,
that's why I was taught at a Baptist college.
Uh-huh, yeah. Succeeded in converting an emperor, and that's a good thing to do.
Was because the cult of Isis required all the priests to be castrated, so they didn't get a whole lot of volunteers. volunteers.
Yeah, that's true.
The Chinese have a saying, no 10 things, tell 9. Yeah, I think this, what I'm raising, just sort of placing in the floor between us, is this notion of the place of, well, let's just even use the word secrecy in a religious tradition. That goes in ways that rubs us the wrong way with our democratic sentiments. Everything should be out in the open, no closed books and this sort of thing. But I wonder if that's always right. Let's take the Native Americans, so powerfully present to us in this spot and this weekend through Sun Bear. I live 5 miles from a reservation, the Onondaga Reservation, people of the hills, as Onondaga means. And I have something of the relationship with two the chiefs there, Shenandoah, Chief Shenandoah and Chief Lyons, that Joan has to Sun Bear and others. And I love those people and spend as much time out on the reservation as I can manage. And I've made a mental note. I hope I don't forget to tell Joan that they ought to bring Chief Lyons here, because, boy, he could give you a weekend. But what I'm saying is that with all that rapport, someone called us some time ago, asked, and long distance, says, is this a convenient time to talk? And I said, well, I've got 6 chiefs in my living room. Could you call back another time? The person at the other end said he had never received a response on the phone like that. But what I'm saying is, with all this rapport, when they go into their longhouse for their tribal meetings, I stay outdoors. I cool my heels at the door. And when I take them to groups to make presentations, because I think it's nothing is more important in our American culture than that we perceive the richness and the contribution of the Native American base. When I take them, I remember the first time I said, of course you'll be expounding your worldview, but could you also do some of your sacred dances for them? And the Chief Shenandoah said, well, we'll dance for them, omitting the word sacred, because, as he explained, I felt so gauche in not having picked up on that verse. The sacred dances are not for public profane eyes. And another aspect of it, the last summer I wanted to take them to New York to a group that was of students that were going around the world studying world religions. And so they were glad to go. 5 of them indeed went. But the dates that I wanted them, they said, well, this is when the time of year when we are repeating our law. And I said, okay, I respect that. How long will it take? 8 days. So the New York, the World Religions Group had to cool its heel till those 8 days were over. And that law is not written down. It's all oral, and they will not write it down. And that's why they have to gather once a year to refresh their memory, and they repeat it through all the way. And if anybody notices there are any variations that have come in or any omissions, why, they check all that out to keep it all intact. And they said, regarding the dances, they said, you know, the parts of our rituals that we have exposed and shared to others have not survived. It's the part that we have kept to ourselves that endure. All this is a question of the place of esotericism. Somebody last night at supper asked me, do you have any initiatic names? And I said, yes. And said, can you tell them? And I said, I can tell you all but one, because one I was given on condition that I would never divulge what that is. Again, you come up to this esoteric component. But I don't find it anywhere in Christianity today. Is it in Judaism? Is there an esoteric?
There definitely is.
I mean, in the sense of secret, not to be divulged.
Well, in the Jewish tradition, in order to study the mysticism, there's a saying which you can take metaphorically that you have to be married with children and be 40 years of age. Mm-hmm. And also the Jewish mystical tradition is not written down. There is no book of the Kabbalah. I mean, there are books with that title, but there's no.
The Zohar.
That is the text, quote, of mysticism, but still Kabbalah is not written down. It is still something which is received. I think that's what the word means, is to receive, and it's not received through written.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's somewhat different, though. An oral tradition, not written down, is one thing. An oral tradition, which also one is placed under orders on receiving it not to divulge, except to another initiatic, is something else. Is that present in Judaism?
I would say, in that way, no. But there is an age and there are restrictions.
Right, not that. And I don't know anywhere within Christendom where that esoteric in the sense of secret appears. But I wonder whether that's as it should be.
But in Judaism, it could be said that the material has its own veil. Mm-hmm.
That's always true.
So there's no need to place that restriction.
Well, yeah, that's certainly understandable and valid. But again, I don't know that that fully answers the question, because in this truly secret, in the sense of privileged and protected, there is the notion that the veil will not be seen, and therefore what is veiled becomes misinterpreted. Is that notion? I just raise this as a question.
I think that's what my question was last night. Is it, will things keep going on, or should we try to, or should we reveal, you know, what has been revealed to us to the people?
Say that again. I don't quite.
Okay, I asked you a question, something about if the world was going to keep going on. You know, things, should the things that have been revealed be revealed to other people, or should they be kept secret?
I
guess that would have been a better question.
Mm-hmm. Joan, just in a sentence to bring you up to date, we've been on the esoteric feature of Christian Gnosticism, and raising the whole question of the place of esotericism as secret, not to be divulged. What place that has within a tradition. That's right. All right. Now, we're itemizing now the components of Christian mysticism, and esotericism is one aspect. Yes, Leon.
Just one thought that came to mind was where there's a need for secrecy is usually in the field of practice.
Uh-huh.
That certain practices should not be given out until the disciple is ready to receive them.
Yeah.
And I feel that is a correct mode of secrecy.
All right. I concur on the importance of that, but is it implied that within the category of knowing knowledge principles as over against practice, there is not a place for comparable secrecy? See, every tradition is a blend of wisdom and method, those two together, flying like two wings of a bird or like we walk on two legs, and it's not, you can be sure it's not an authentic tradition unless it has both of those. But you've said, yes, in method, why clearly we can see there are things that should be reserved and taught only to the initiatic. But how about wisdom? While you're thinking about this, I'll tell you what comes to mind in terms of Christianity. In India, one time, up in the north, around Almora, I think it was. Yes, it was in Almora. Suddenly a figure appeared before me that was arresting. Now, to say a figure is arresting in India, like they're all over the place. But this one, you know, really set me back on. Tall, taller, I think, perhaps, than I am. Beard. Dressed entirely in white. It turned out to be Father Lazarus, an Eastern Orthodox monk who had been in India for 20 years. And I was absolutely fascinated with Father Lazarus. And for 3 days, you know, I just forgot all about the sadhus and the holy man, and I just hung out with Father Lazarus. And we were talking about all kinds of things, and I remember particularly how he saw the relation of his Eastern Orthodox Christianity to Hinduism, because I was very much involved in that question. And because he had clearly an immense empathy for Hinduism and was not missionary in any kind of crude way whatsoever. And I told him, I said, you know, one of the things that that puts me off about Christianity is that I believe in universal salvation. That in the end, you know, however long or however you want to conceive of that, everybody gets there. And in Christianity, there's the notion of eternal damnation. And there was something in me that saw that as a monstrous doctrine. And Father Lazarus said, well, I see what you mean. He said, well, I have my own interpretation on that point. And he said, you remember the passage in which St. Paul speaks of having been caught up into the third heaven? And boy, that's a fabulous passage where he said, whether in the body or out of the body, I know not. Just right, you know, just right. I was there, but whether my body was with me or was not, I don't know. And there I was shown things that I wish I could remember there, but was forbidden ever to speak. Now, he said, I have my theory about what he was then shown and told, and that is that in the end, we're all saved, universal salvation. But he said, you cannot tell everybody that, because most people, given the pulls of the flesh and inertia, will take that as a counsel to complacency. And that's why he, in other words, he, in so many words, he was saying, he himself held that as an esoteric teaching within Christianity itself. Now that would be an example of secrecy in doctrine or in wisdom to go along with the secrecy in method that you mentioned.
Let me ask a functional question. Would you like me to pull the windows back?
Okay. Great. Just continue. Here we are, probably before long, too. Yes, I should say. Boy, when the windows come down, they come down, don't they? Myron said it's the lifting of the veil, the rending of the veil, it's a revelation, re-veiling. Revelation literally means pulling back of the veil. Yeah. So we just had it. Well, we don't want to shut out some possibility for strolling before lunch, but should we go on for a few? It's now 12:22.
What I'd like for us to go on for half an hour.
All right, good.
Lunch will be until about 1:30.
Fine. Let's go then until about 1, and then we'll have a half hour. All right, the second component of Gnostic Christianity has to do with the notion of the incarnation. Now, the incarnation, of course, is central to Christianity. But my, talk about mysteries and koans and the mind being brought to a stop. It certainly is there. And even the exoteric creeds have that element within it. Because yesterday we were talking about Martian and the Apostles' Creed, but when we come down to the Creed of Chalcedon, and the Athanasian Creed, why, it's just one just paradox, paradox, paradox after the other. Both, all aimed regarding the carnation of saying no to duality. Because they're an affirmation of very God of very God. So the divine is nailed down 100%. But then the human is nailed down 100% too. On the divine side, begotten, not made, because made would mean an inferior being, whereas in begotten, the son is as human as the parents, a daughter is as human as the parent. All right? Total God and total man. Now, theology struggles, twists, squirms in how to make intelligible sense out of this. But let's go now to the Gnostic emphasis, which viewed the incarnation as the paradigm for every life, the anticipation and model for every life. That is to say, and it comes out in the phrase, God our contemporary. But we have to take that, Christ our contemporary. Now, whereas in exoteric Christianity, Christ was taken as a kind of model to emulate, the Gnostic emphasis is that this incarnation means body, of course, carnal body, the incursion of the divine into the human takes place within each individual. So Christ becomes a metaphor which our lives are to exemplify. A metaphor that becomes the model of our lives. Not that we become like the historical Jesus, imitating the imitation of Christ, thinking of this life back then, and we do as much in our way of behavior. We try to emulate that aspect. That's all part of it, just like the vertical dimension yesterday does not obliterate the gradual, but it goes beyond it and cuts through it. Namely, that this becomes, we are ourselves to become Christ. Does that make sense? So that the Gnostic interpretation of Christ, it's a kind of appropriation of Christ rather than an imitation in any more external fashion. One could even put it in terms of a verb. A Christing in our lives, which is simply that the divine is allowed to enter so that this incomprehensible fusion, absolute fusion, of divine and human is realized in us. All right. Third. Now, we've talked about infusion in number two in Christology. The incoming. Oh, by the way, before, one last thing occurs to me on the Christology. Even in the exoteric, Irenaeus, the theologian, came out with a statement that's really in this direction. God became man in order that man might become God.
May I ask a technical question? Technically, how is that possible since Christ was conceived by the Holy Ghost?
All right.
What?
So are we all.
I was going to put it in proof text term by quoting scripture, but the Spirit bloweth. See, the Holy Ghost.